start out by saying that everything I say today is not work that I do anymore myself, because I barely get to do anything anymore myself. But I do have an enormously talented group of students and postdocs working with me, and I just wanted to put all their names up and give them full credit for having done everything that it is that I'm about to talk about, and not to give any of you the impression that I actually get any real work done anymore. So I thought I would start. I was told that this is meant to be a colloquium, and I understood this to mean that there would be non-experts in the room, so I should go and actually talk about what it is that we're talking about and not assume that everybody knows everything already. So I'm going to give a brief overview of the state of the art of CMB temperature and isotropy data, which is what most people historically have thought about, thought of in terms of what is the CMB, what do we care, why are we interested. And for those of you who know all about this, you're free to fall asleep, and then later in the talk there'll be a quiz and you'll be able to tell me what was the hole, what was the ancient hole, and what is the Holy Grail. And as long as you can do that, you can sleep through the whole first part. So you guys can all pass out. For those of you who are not completely well versed in all of this stuff, I'm going to be talking a little bit about the Sinyaev-Zeldovich effect, which is sort of the first step away from looking at primary CMB anisotropies, and looking rather at what we call secondary anisotropies, which are fluctuations that are imprinted on the CMB not at the surface of last scattering, but as the CMB propagates from the surface of last scattering to our detectors. So another way of looking at the universe when it was more formed than the CMB. And then I'm going to talk about CMB polarization. And for those of you who are planning on sleeping, this is a giant clue for the quiz at the end. This is what I personally am really excited about, because this is really the only way that we have, that I can think of really probing what was going on with the universe when it was much, much less than a second old, observationally. So I refer to this as the Holy Grail. All right, so this is the Cliff Notes slide. So this is a WMAP slide, conveniently placing everything that's ever happened in the universe on a slide that you can actually put on a transparency, or a PowerPoint, or whatever it is these are called these days. So just to tell you what I'm going to be talking about, the first thing I'll talk about is inflation. Just a few words from an experimentalist perspective, and for those of you theorists who didn't realize I was an experimentalist, I'm sorry. I will actually talk a little bit about equipment, and I will represent things like inflation by wizards. And those wizards are you guys, which is great, because then you can tell me what really happened, and I can tell you if you're right or not. So something like inflation or something happened in the very early universe that made this universe created from what other people might say was nothing, or creationists who call me in my office say that we don't know and how could we even talk about this and that I should go to hell. And I always thought that wasn't very fair because, anyway, well. So then we're going to talk a little bit about the photon baryon fluid, or the thing that generates the cosmic microwave background. Then we'll talk about the cosmic microwave background itself and what we hope to learn both from temperature anisotropies, about which I'll say essentially only that it's already been done, and really talk about polarization anisotropy. And then a few words about secondary anisotropies, or the SE effect. Not necessarily in that order. That's the chronological universe order, not my perverse presentation order. All right, so inflation, you all know about this. The idea is when the universe was much, much less than a second old, quantum fluctuations in the primordial density field are somehow stretched to cosmic scales during a period of rapid expansion. And the idea is these fluctuations in the energy density lead to fluctuations in the local gravitational potential, and you get these potential wells and potential hills, and these end up manifesting themselves as regions of higher and lower density. So if you step forward a little bit in time, you can think about the first 3 minutes of the history of the universe as a time when, just after the inflationary epoch, the universe continues to expand and cool, but much more slowly. And you get a number of phase transitions that take place where you break some fundamental symmetries, you differentiate particle species, and I don't need to tell you people in this room very much about the details here, so I'll skip the details. Then you get to the age between about 3 minutes and about 380,000 years, which is really the most boring period of time in the history of the universe. Essentially, nothing goes on. The universe is hot, it's dense, it expands, it cools, And really very little changes apart from the energy density and the temperature decreasing. During this time, as you know, electrons are bound to baryons through electromagnetic interactions, and photons are coupled to these free electrons through Thomson scattering. And so what you get is this situation where the baryons are falling into the potential wells created by the dark matter. They're dragging the photons into the potential wells. The photons don't like to be pressed together. They heat up, and eventually you get a bounce. So you get this characteristic oscillation of the photon-baryon fluid in these potential wells. And as long as the universe is hot enough so that the electrons are bound to the baryons and bound to the photons, this keeps going. Okay, so the photons are, the universe is optically thick, the photons are bound in with the baryonic matter. So the purple bits I'm taking as results of inflation, and the black bits I'm taking as things that we do to understand what it is that we're thinking about. So the idea is that during inflation, you lay down potential fluctuations on all scales. And if you're a good physicist, the first thing you will do is Fourier decompose these fluctuations into plane waves. And you have distinct wavelengths of these plane waves, distinct modes. All of these modes with a given wave number are in phase. In other words, the oscillations are coherent because they start at the same time. But you have all different modes. So this set of special modes that I wrote down up at the top is not yet a set of special modes. There's nothing special about these modes. There are all sorts of modes that happen. And all you know is that if you pick any given mode, all of the modes with wave numbers related by integral multiples have related oscillation frequencies. Okay, so if we were to designate some mode as a special mode, you would have a bunch of other modes that are related to that mode. Okay, so what designates something as a special mode? The surface of last scattering, also called recombination, which is weird because it's the first time you get the combination of electrons with protons to create neutral hydrogen atoms. What happens then is the Green-free path for Compton scattering goes way, way down. In other words, the photons stop scattering off of the free electrons because there aren't very many free electrons anymore. The photons escape, they free stream. And now, as the baryons try to collapse into the dark matter potential wells, there's no more photon pressure to prevent that from happening. You get a runaway collapse, the photons get away, and you actually start to form large-scale structure with the baryonic matter and the dark matter. And the photons give you a bath of radiation that you can go and detect with detectors that we call the cosmic microwave background. So just the cartoon version, I'll skip through this one very quickly. The cartoon version of what happens to the baryonic matter is it starts out with fluctuations, matter begins to collapse. As it collapses enough, it heats up. You generate the first set of stars that get formed. And then in the end, you generate billions and billions of all sorts of things that astronomers like to go and look at. And we think of as foregrounds or irritants or things that we need to worry about when we're trying to see the cosmic microwave background. So what happens with the radiation? The radiation escapes off the surface of last scattering, and it acts just like the surface of a cloud. So if you think about looking into a cloud, you don't see the light that's emitted inside the cloud, because as soon as it gets emitted, it bounces around and hits another particle of water that's in the cloud. So what you see when you look at the cloud is just the surface of the cloud. This is just exactly the same thing that's going on with the CMB. You don't see what's going on before the photons decouple, but as soon as they decouple, now you have these photons that are free streaming through the universe. And as long as they don't crash into anything else before they hit your detector, you have a very clean signal of what the universe looked like before the formation of any stars or galaxies or structure that we think of in the universe. And it turns out the space is mostly empty. So at least to first order, we get a pretty clean picture of what the cosmic microwave background looks like. And that's what all those images that you see of the WMAP data and other data are showing you. It's the initial fluctuations in the CMB. So when we think about setting a set of special modes or decoupling, you imagine that if all the oscillations have started at the same time, at decoupling, there's a certain set of modes that get picked out. It could have been any of them. It's whatever random time decoupling happens. But when it does happen, there is a mode that has had time just to collapse once. There's one that's had time to collapse once and then rarefy. There's one that's collapsed twice, and so on. Okay, and these modes that get picked out are picked out because at maximum collapse or maximum rarefaction, you have regions that are hottest and coldest in the cosmic microwave background. So you pick those regions out when you go and look at the black body radiation coming from the cosmic microwave background. You see this as regions of slightly hotter and slightly colder black body radiation. But because you have this set of modes that are related by integer multiples, you get these characteristic peaks in the cosmic microwave background when you look at the power spectrum. And so this is why, for those of you who are not used to looking at this power spectrum every day but have seen it and wondered why it looks the way it does, what you're seeing is on the y-axis, this is essentially fluctuation power. And on this axis is angular scale, but backwards. Okay, so if you go in this direction, you're going to smaller angular scale. And what you see is on the very largest scales, you see the primordial perturbation spectrum. At about a degree, you see the mode that has had time to collapse only once. And then the second peak is the one that's collapsed once and then rarefied, so it's a rarefaction maximum. And then the next one is the one that's collapsed twice, and so on. So keep in mind that the odd peaks are compression maxima, and the even peaks are rarefaction maxima. And this is useful. In a minute, I'll show you some interesting things you can learn from that. All right, so when we first started this game, the first thing people did was go and think that there was pigeon shit on antennas and things like this, and then they discovered that actually we were looking at light from the early universe, and that was really cool. And then Kobe went and discovered that this was an enormously good black body, the best black body ever measured, and that was really cool. And then the question was, okay, well, we do see these fluctuations, and let's find out where this first peak is, right? And this first peak tells you something about the geometry of the universe. And so this was kind of the first easy thing to go and measure once we knew that we had a black body CMB and once we knew that fluctuations existed. And the idea here is that it takes longer for a fluid to collapse in a large potential well than a small one. Okay, that's not rocket science. If you have a small potential, it doesn't take very long to cross that distance. If you have a big one, it takes longer. And the distance that the fluid can collapse in the time between when the oscillations start and when decoupling sets in sets the size of the largest potential well that can collapse. Okay, and this is dependent on the sound horizon. So the oscillations in the photon baryon fluid are acoustic in the sense that they result from compressions and expansions of the fluid. That's where that term comes from. And the oscillation frequency is set by the speed of sound in that fluid. And I put that in for my students. You guys don't need that, I guess. Although David Hogg, I think, was supposed to be here, and I think he was the science advisor for that film, although I'm not sure he would admit it, so maybe I just outed him. Or maybe it was a rumor and it's not actually true. I don't know. Anyway, so if you're interested in looking at this first Doppler peak, keep in mind that the scale of the sound horizon in the photon baryon fluid sets the maximal size of this causally connected region. And the physical size of the sound horizon depends very weakly on cosmological parameters. So what you can do is you can go and measure the angular size. In other words, how far apart are these fluctuations that you're measuring? Where is the peak in that fluctuation, in the fluctuation power? That is, that gives you the characteristic angular scale at which those fluctuations occur. And that tells you, if you know this physical size, so if you start out with three different versions of the same physical size, you calculate what the angular size would be for a flat universe, and then you know that the angle should be smaller if the universe is negatively curved or larger if it's positively curved. Okay, so just by analyzing where those fluctuations are on the maps that you make, in this power spectrum, in other words, if you look at where this peak happens in L space, okay, which direction it shifts back and forth here, you get a very clean measurement of the geometry of the universe. So this was one of the first things we did. This was something I did for my thesis experiments, and then other people have done that. Go and measure that first peak and figure out where it is. And it turns out where it is about a degree, and that's consistent with a flat universe. And this is a picture that's been evolving for a while, and everybody knows about it. Just to give you a sense of some of the of another parameter that's easy to see how it works in the CMB spectrum, you can also look at the baryon density. So there are lots and lots of cosmological parameters that go into making one of these curves. Okay, you put in the age of the universe and the dark matter content and the baryonic matter content and the dark energy and all this kind of stuff. You put it in, you turn through it, and you get a power spectrum that looks something like this. And you tweak any one of those knobs and things shift around. And there are some degeneracies. The geometry is an easy thing to see because it shifts the peak in one direction or the other. Another thing that's pretty easy to see how it works is the baryon density. So if you, imagine cranking up the number of baryons in the universe, and you think about what's happening when you have these dark matter potential wells, the baryons are dragging the photons into the potential wells. And if you have more baryons, then your compression maxima are going to be enhanced relative to your rarefaction maxima. Okay, so you get a deeper compression and less of a rarefaction. The baryons are winning over your photons more than they would have been if you had a smaller number. So you can see as you change the baryon content, the relative height of the even and odd peaks shifts around. So this is another clean signature to look for. All right, you can look up the rest. I think Wayne Hu and Max Tegmark still have all sorts of nice tools on their website where you can turn knobs and you can see the power spectrum shift around, and that's very cool. All right, so this is where we were in 2006 with the WMAP data. We now have a really nice measurement of the first couple of peaks. And then if you add other data right around the third peak, this is what they call WMAP extended, where they add ACBAR and CBI and some other instruments that measure higher angular scales. Actually, that one may just be W, that's just WMAP, but there's some more points out there that you can get. So what you find out is that the primary CMB anisotropy spectrum out to a couple of peaks has been really pretty well measured. So if you're an experimentalist and you are not ready to retire, and this is all you are going to do, you'd have to figure out something else to do. So those of us who don't really want to retire and don't really want to work on McDonald's have been working really hard to figure out how to talk to theorists and figure out what else we should be looking for. The one thing I will say about what came out of the WMAP data that maybe everybody takes for granted now that I just think is kind of funny is when we looked at the results for how this parameter fitting, when you compare WMAP data to large-scale structure data and supernova data, what we got was that 4% of the universe is made out of stuff that we know anything about. 22% is made out of some form of dark matter that we maybe have guesses about, but we don't really know. And 74% is some dark energy. We don't even know if it's dark energy. Maybe it's some gravity thing. We have no idea. And everyone went, yeah, that's right. I just still think it's so cool. And we wonder why reporters call us up and say we don't know what we're talking about. All right, so where are we going? Really two directions. One is to look at smaller angular scales. So on that plot that I showed you a minute ago, you can see the error bars start to blow up as you go to smaller L. And in fact, they blow up right around, and this is, I mean, coincidental that this is true. It's an experimental thing that the error bars blow up. But right around the point where the primary CMB ceases to dominate the fluctuation spectrum that you expect to measure, and you start seeing the effect of little tiny objects in the sky, like clusters of galaxies and things like that, that become real nuisance when you're trying to look at these large scale structures on the CMB. If you start looking at angular scales around an arc minute, you see clusters, and if you look smaller, you see irritating things like galaxies, and you worry about dust and things like that, point sources. And so you could either be annoyed about those things, or you can say, well, there's actually something to learn from that. And I'll talk a little bit about how using the CMB to light up structure that has formed later in the universe can actually be interesting. I don't think it's as interesting personally as what you do if instead of looking at the smaller angular scales in the CMB, you look at how the light is polarized in the CMB. And I'll talk about why I think that's interesting in a few minutes. All right, so first I want to say a few words about these little tiny objects called clusters of galaxies. And I saw the title of the workshop was something like Astrophysics from Cosmological Observations, or I'm probably butchering this in some horrible way, but it was something about astrophysics, and I thought that was really interesting. So I didn't scrub this part out of my talk. So for those of you who are not interested in astrophysics, you can go to sleep. But there's some cosmology here, but really it's probably more astrophysics, in my humble opinion. Anyway, so if you look at the very largest collapsed objects in the whole universe, you will find clusters of galaxies. And if you're a astronomical ignoramus like I have traditionally been, you will think of a cluster of galaxies as a place in the sky where there are a whole bunch of galaxies that you can observe with optical telescopes. And you might think of them looking something like this. But it turns out that the composition of galaxy clusters is largely dark matter, right? It's about 90% dark matter. And of the baryonic matter in the clusters, about 90% of that is gas, not galaxies. Okay, and this gas is hot because it lives in a very deep cluster potential well, which means that you have free electrons again. So it means that as a cosmic microwave background photon goes through a cluster of galaxies, about 1% of the time it's going to get scattered. So this is bad if what you want to look at is pristine CMB. It's not that bad if you actually want to learn something about what's going on with clusters. So this is called the Sinyaev-Zeldovich effect. And you could imagine what happens is you take this beautiful CMB black body spectrum in red, and as the photon comes through the cluster, you upscatter, remember, because the gas in the cluster is hot. So you take this cold CMB photon, you boost it to higher energy. So you're depleting the low frequency end of this spectrum, and you're boosting some of the photons up to higher energy. So you create a distortion in the black body spectrum. And then if you do something that radio astronomers do, and you plot this rather than as a function, the intensity as a function of frequency, you plot it as a delta T, a change in the black body temperature measured as a function of frequency. What you see is that if you had no change, you would get this black line. And if you take this blue line and put it in these units, what you see is that you get a decrement at low frequency and an increment as you go up to higher frequency. So if you go with a radio telescope around 30 gigahertz and you look in the sky, you will see on scales of about an arc minute, which is the size of a cluster, you'll see things that look like holes in the sky. In other words, a decrement in the number of photons that you expect to see there. So this is cool because you can imagine doing a survey and looking for all the clusters in some patch of sky. And if you think about normally, if you're looking at objects in the universe, you're looking at things that behave like a light bulb. As you move your light bulb further and further away, what happens is it gets dimmer. Anything that emits light behaves like that. But if you think about the source for the SZ effect, the source is the cosmic microwave background. So wherever you put your cluster, you get essentially the same magnitude of the effect. It doesn't care how far away it is, which means that unlike surveys that you do in the X-ray or in the optical, it's essentially a redshift independent measurement. It depends really to first order only on the mass of the cluster. Okay, now I will claim that this is famous last words, and in fact there's all sorts of messy, complicated astrophysics and evolution effects, and you're studying the SZ effect, you're really studying the physics of clusters of galaxies. But there are lots of people who would disagree with me. And in fact, I sort of disagreed with me when we started building this instrument called the Sinyaev-Zeldovich array. So this instrument was designed to go and look for this effect specifically. It was specifically designed to go out and do a survey just like that. This experiment was started by John Carlstrom at Chicago, with whom I worked when I was a Hubble Fellow, and then we collaborated when I moved to Columbia. So it was his team and my team, and then people at Caltech and the Owens Valley. So the basic idea with this instrument is you start out with small dishes. So typically with an interferometer, you have big dishes and you put them really far apart. And the idea is that you use the technique of interferometry to be able to get very high resolution measurements. But we're looking at big objects. Okay, now I said clusters were these little tiny things. From astronomy perspective, they're giant, great, huge things. So you don't need the ultra high resolution that you would have if you use something like the VLA. And in fact, if you use that, you screw everything up. You resolve out the cluster completely, and you don't see it at all. So we built 8 3.5-meter telescopes. And we packed 6 of them really close together. So the idea was to maximize the surface brightness, use the fact that it's an interferometer to minimize systematic effects, and then keep our sensitivity high. And then we take 2 of them and we put them out further away. And what that does is the ones that are in the close pack configuration give you sensitivity to cluster scales. So you get nice measurements of big things using the compact array. And the ones further away give you measurements, the baselines you get, the combinations of telescopes with one close and one far, or too far, give you measurements of things that are smaller, which means you can simultaneously reject point sources, which is a good thing. So we built two sets of receivers at 30 and 90. So both of them are in the region where the SD effect is expected to be a decrement. But it gives you 2 different frequencies to use to measure different scales in the cluster, but also to measure spectral indices of things in the cluster. And we're now taking science data. We have been for a couple of years. Yeah?
Remind us what surface brightness.
Surface brightness? It's essentially a measure of how many photons you're getting in a region. So here it is getting built. Here are the receivers getting built in my lab at Columbia. Here it is almost built. You can see that some of the dishes have panels, some don't. Here it is looking like it's observing something really technical. It's observing the correlator trailer, but that's OK. This is in the Owens Valley out of California. So here is the first data that we published from this, the only data we've published so far, not the only data we have. So this was just to give us an idea that this instrument's actually working. This is 3 high redshift clusters out at redshift around 1. And you can see that we calculated the masses and temperatures. I didn't put them up here, but we did this. They agree with the X-ray determined values. We see the cluster, we can remove point sources, basically just this instrument works and, hey, we can see some high redshift clusters and this is cool sort of result. All right, so what are we doing? So there are a couple different things you can do. You can look at a survey, in other words, take a blank patch of sky and do what I was saying before, go and search for all the clusters that live in that blank patch. Or you can go and point the instrument at individual clusters and study the astrophysics of what's going on with these clusters. So way back, people like Gil Holder and Joe Moore were making plots that looked like this, that looked really cool and promising, and it looked like you could do all of this incredible cosmology, because if you go and count the number of clusters you find in a patch of sky as a function of the redshift where you find them, the curves that you get are very different depending on different cosmologies. And this is really cool. And it's a complementary way to all sorts of other cosmological measurements to measure what things are like, the geometry of the universe and the matter density and all these, the matter content, dark matter and all this kind of stuff. In fact, we already know that we live in the blue curve, okay, on these plots. And what we would really like to know is if we were to, for example, change the equation of state of the universe, you get a little perturbation on the blue curve away from omega lambda equals 0.7, omega matter is 0.3. And the question is, could you distinguish between a W of minus 1 and a W of minus 0.3 universe? So W is the equation of state of the universe. The dark energy. So the question is here, can you do that? Can you distinguish between things that are little tiny perturbations here? If you ask me, I would say this is going to be really, really hard. Some people are much more optimistic than I am, so you can take what I'm saying or leave it. But the question really is, this assumes that you know the mass of a cluster. Okay, so what you're saying is, the SC decrement depends only on the cluster, the mass of the cluster. You know that there's a sharp cutoff in mass. So if you take all the clusters above some given mass, you put them in your survey, everybody else is out of your survey, then you can make plots that look like this. Okay, and if you don't know the mass of your cluster, you have to be much more careful. So you really need to understand the physics of these clusters, so you make sure that you understand what the mass is. I think that interesting cosmology can probably be done, but I think there's a lot of astrophysics that has to get done first to make sure that we know what we're doing. So take this with a grain of salt, but it is a complementary way to measure cosmology, so it's not a bad idea to do it. One thing that we will measure very well is sigma 8, which is the RMS linear fluctuations in the mass distribution on scales of 8 megaparsecs. It's the normalization of the matter power spectrum. And the reason that you measure that so well is that the number of clusters that you expect to see scales as a very high power of sigma 8. So in other words, you have many more clusters as that normalization shifts, or many fewer. And the other thing that's cool about this is you can test for non-Gaussianity. I'm not going to say a lot about that, but if you think about it, if you are looking for non-Gaussianity in the cosmic microwave background, there are lots of ways to mess up your measurement so that you get something in your data that looks like it could be a non-Gaussian signature. If you see a big bright cluster living at redshift of 4 or something out here where you really shouldn't see any at all, and you can see it and verify that it's there, something's going on. And if you have more than one or two, something's really going on. So it could be a smoking gun. May or may not be. We haven't seen anything like that yet, but these surveys are just getting going. The other thing that we've started thinking about a little bit is what happens if you have scale-dependent non-Gaussianity. So if you have a non-Gaussianity that doesn't evade the CMB scales, but it changes as a function of scale. And Mari, who's sitting here, has just posted a paper that we worked on with Licia Verity and Sarah Shandera about this. So, I mean, you could imagine using clusters to be a complementary probe of non-Gaussianity, actually measuring different things, not exactly the same thing. The other thing you can do is go ahead and measure the cosmic microwave background on much smaller scales. So this is the cosmic microwave background angular power spectrum plot that I showed before, but on really bizarre scale, so that all of those peaks that WMAP measured really nicely are right in there. And you can see the primary angular power spectrum falling off very quickly. And then you expect that the angular power spectrum due to diffuse power from clusters of galaxies rises up somewhere in here. So there have been measurements done by CBI and by the BIMA teams, and we're going to get points that fit right in here. So we'll be able to measure what that amplitude is, which is another really nice way of measuring this parameter sigma 8. The other thing you can do, of course, is then go and look at pointed cluster observations. And in fact, we've done a lot of this with this instrument. You can do all sorts of things, and I've written down a bunch of ideas here. But the basic idea with all of it is, how well can we understand what these clusters are actually about? So you don't really want to go with pointed observations and look only at SC data. You really want to combine with X-ray data and optical data, lensing data maybe, and really try to understand what are the masses, what are the temperatures, how messy are these things, are they messier as you go to higher redshift? All these complicated things that will prevent you from getting cosmology if you don't really understand them well. So I'll just say a few words about what one of my thesis students has been working on this front. He's developed this improved model for reconstructing cluster parameters. And this is very much astrophysics, so those of you who are not interested in astrophysics can fall asleep. But the idea here is that you need a model to use to simultaneously fit the SC data and the X-ray data that doesn't demand that the profile of the SC be identical to the profile of the X-ray. And a lot of times what's been done in the past is you use a beta model, which is a classic model that's been used for X-ray. You use the X-ray data, which is much higher quality typically, to constrain the shape of that profile. You impose that on the SC, and then you use the SC to get a normalization and things like that. So what he's done instead is fit the SC data, which is essentially a measure of the pressure in the cluster, to a NFW, Navarro-Franken-White profile, and use a modified beta model, which is similar to what's been done in the X-ray before, with a couple of extra free parameters to do a little bit better, to fit the density, which comes from the X-ray. And then you use the ideal gas law to relate the two. So you link those two, rather than by an identical profile, you link them by the ideal gas law, and you solve for the temperature. So you don't use X-ray spectroscopic information. And what we find is that we recover the integrated SC decrement much more faithfully using simulations than you do with a beta model. And you get a measure of the temperature that agrees with spectroscopic temperatures, which is interesting because then at higher redshift, where you don't have spectroscopic temperature profiles, you still can get a measure of the temperature. So this is just an example of one of the mock clusters that we fit. So this is the integrated Y parameter, as a function of the radius out into the cluster. And you can see that if you fit a beta model, you get this red curve. The black curve is the true answer from the simulation, and the blue is what we get when we use this technique. So you get a much better reconstruction. And the reason for that is the beta model ends up getting driven by what's going on in the very densest part of the cluster. And you don't get that when you combine the data in this way.
Any noise added? And did it have a microwave background?
No. This is just one of Daisuke's clusters. So we've done a whole bunch of these from different projections.
SD alone, if you find a cluster, how many parameters can you fit?
Depends on the data. Depends on what instruments you have and how long your integration is and all that kind of stuff. The data we're using, we don't constrain more than a couple, two, three parameters independently using the SC alone. Actually, in this plot, you can see the pink is what happens if you constrain this using the SC alone on this guy, and the blue is what you get if you include the X-ray.
But basically, you can't find both the redshift and the mask?
No. You don't get the redshift. You get the redshift using optical data. Well, by parameters here, we mean if you parameterize the shape of the model, using a radius and using various parameters that go into the shape, then you can constrain a couple of those.
So what I'm confused about is that if you find a cluster only to SC, then you don't know what redshift is it.
Right. So you don't want to do that. You have to follow up with optical to get the redshift. But a lot of these clusters, I mean, particularly in the smaller surveys, are going to live in regions that have been studied already in the optical. So you don't have to do an entire sky follow-up. But SPT and ACT, which are going to be much bigger, are very carefully figuring out how to do their optical follow-up, so they make sure they have those redshifts. So here's what we get if we test what happens. We tested this on simulations. It looks good, too. But here's a real cluster, a cluster that's been studied very, very well in the X-ray. So one that's nice and close by. It's massive. It's been studied. So what we do is we compare what happens if you do this fitting in the SC and the X-ray and derive a temperature from what you get from an X-ray spectroscopic temperature. And you can see that the black is the spectroscopic temperature, the blue is the recovered temperature using this technique.
And they really trace each other very well. So this is nice. It's a promising way of saying, how can we get temperatures and masses for clusters that are far enough away that you might only get one isothermal temperature when you fit them spectroscopically. You don't have many points to get the whole profile, unless you observe them for a long time with X-ray telescopes. All right, so I don't want to say any more about that right now. If people are interested in the astrophysics of those clusters, I'm happy to talk about that later on. I'll be around all day tomorrow. So I wanted to spend the rest of the talk talking about CMB polarization. And this is what I think is really a lot of people are kind of banking on this being the next really exciting thing that happens in the CMB. Now, it could be that we don't have B modes, which is what I'll talk about in a minute, and that this is a little bit of a false chase, but I don't think so. I think either way, we're going to learn something. So the idea is if you were to take a map on the sky and look at how light is polarized, you can, just to start out, you can say, all right, just purely mathematically, we could imagine separating polarization into two different types of polarization, just like you do with vector and scalar modes in electromagnetism. You can say, you can do the same thing. You can say, you can pick out a set of scalar modes and a set of vector modes. And this is just a mathematical question. And so far, there's no physics in this. I'm not telling you what is a scalar mode and what is a vector mode. But just that you could do that, and you can think of polarization as being comprised of E modes, which are the scalar modes, and B modes, which are the vector modes. All right, so how do we generate polarization in the first place? If you imagine an entirely isotropic radiation field, you will get linear polar, you will get no polarization at all on scattering. Okay, so if there were no CMB anisotropies, you would expect no polarization anisotropies. If you have a quadrupole anisotropy, then something more interesting happens. So in other words, if you have an electron sitting here, and you have a brighter region on this side and that side, and a dimmer region on this side and that side, right? So you take unpolarized radiation coming in from this direction, and you pick out the component. There's a component here as it comes in this direction. It will oscillate this electron in a direction perpendicular to your line of sight and in a direction parallel to your line of sight. Okay, you can break it up into those two components. The one parallel to your line of sight, you won't see. Okay, so you pick out on this scattering the component perpendicular to your line of sight, and you get a component that's the blue guy here. Right? If you have isotropic radiation, again, the component that you pick out from here is of the same magnitude, and you have unpolarized light. But if you have, if the light coming from this direction and that direction is less intense, then what you get is when you pick out the component perpendicular to the line of sight here, it has a smaller amplitude, and you end up with a linear polarization. Okay, so the upshot of this argument is that if you have quadrupole anisotropies, you can scatter those quadrupole anisotropies into linear polarization. And if you have a density inhomogeneity that creates a quadrupole anisotropy, you generate a curl-free polarization. In other words, the density anisotropy doesn't have a right-handedness or a left-handedness to it. Okay, so it generates a scalar mode or an E mode. Okay, if you have a gravitational wave instead that generates this anisotropy, you get both, right? Because a gravitational wave does have a handedness. So you do generate both a curl-free and a divergence-free component. Okay, so in other words, from the gravitational wave, you get both an E mode and also a B mode. So what this does, if you then go and compute what you would expect, so here is, again, the CMB anisotropy spectrum. This theta-theta is the temperature anisotropy spectrum, so this is the one you've seen over and over. If you take those same temperature anisotropies and you ask what happens if you take the quadrupole anisotropy from the temperature anisotropy and you use that to generate polarization on scattering, you get this curve right here. This is the E mode spectrum. Okay, and if you imagine some set of inflationary models that generate gravitational waves that then propagate through the surface of last scattering, you get a spectrum that looks something like somewhere that fits in here in this swath. Okay, and that's a big wide range because we really don't know the energy scale of inflation. We don't know how inflation happened, and we don't really know that much about what it is we should expect, except that most simple inflation models do predict some form of gravitational waves that you would expect to see, and that they would, you would see them in the B mode spectrum looking something like this. So the idea is, if you can separate out the E modes and the B modes, you do generate also E modes from gravitational waves. You actually also generate temperature anisotropy. But the amplitude is so small that you never expect to see it, where you also have temperature anisotropy and where you also have E modes generated from the scalar perturbations. But you don't get B modes any other way from a primordial signal. So you don't expect to get B modes from temperature anisotropies, which means you don't have a big B mode signal to swamp this smaller signal. So you could expect to see it. Now there's a caveat here, and it's shown by this curve right there, which is that if you take your nice clean E-mode signature and you take those photons and you let them propagate past those annoying clusters of galaxies, you can shear that field, and then you end up getting B-modes produced from E-modes. So you can get a contaminant. You can think of this as a really irritating contaminant. It's actually, in my mind, from an experimental perspective, it might actually be a good thing. Because what we do then is you know the amplitude that this signal should, you know what the shape and the amplitude is of this signal pretty well. Because you know your B-mode, you know your E-modes, and you have a pretty good idea from other experiments what your integrated mass is along the line of sight, which tells you what this amplitude should be. So you know if you lens E into B, you know what that signal should look like. So if you build your experiment and you successfully separate out your E-modes and your B-modes, and you measure this nice signature, then as you get down into this region where it might be harder to tell what you're looking at, you can separate these two out, and you have a lot more confidence that what you're measuring is actually primordial B-modes and not some instrumental effect. So from that perspective, it's a good thing. You can look at it as a glass half full or half empty sort of thing. So why would you care about measuring E-mode polarization if all it does is give you back what you got from your temperature anisotropies? And there are a couple reasons. First, it's generated only by scattering. So it really gives you a nice clean probe of what's going on at the surface of last scattering, rather than what was going on all the way through that period, where you have the photon baryon oscillations, like you do for the temperature anisotropies. Also, it probes the epoch of the reionization from the first stars. So when the first stars turn on, again, you get some ionization, you get photons that are scattered, and you can see that effect. It also serves as a consistency check. In other words, if somehow we had this all completely wrong, and this temperature anisotropy spectrum that we measure isn't in fact coming from where we think it's coming from, then we will know that if we don't see this E-mode spectrum, something is dreadfully wrong. Either we screwed up our measurements and it's there anyway, or we somehow got something wrong. And also, I told you before that there are degeneracies in the cosmological parameters that lead to the shape of that temperature anisotropy spectrum. And if you both measure the temperature anisotropy and the E-mode polarization anisotropy spectrum, you have another set of equations, essentially, so you can break some of those degeneracies. So it gives you another way to measure some of these parameters. So here's where E-mode polarization stands now. And this must be irritating. These plots of the angular power spectrum show up on all different scales with linear and log and, well, get used to it. So this is a version where it's the amplitude is a function of multiple. This is only the E-mode spectrum shown. This is the same spectrum as this green one right here. This is the one where you have the T and the E and the B, and this is the cross-correlation between the two. So this is what WMAP has seen. This is what a whole bunch of other experiments, including WMAP, have seen. And you can see that the state of the art of E-mode polarization now is kind of where temperature anisotropy was 10 or so years ago. So we've seen it. We know it's there. One thing that's sort of cool is if you look at this E-mode spectrum right here, this is not a fit to the data. This is a prediction from what the temperature anisotropy spectrum tells you. Their best fit temperature anisotropy spectrum gives the green curve. And the points that they measure fall right on the green curve. So that's good. Things are consistent. We're not crazy. At least some of us aren't crazy. Oh, that's foreground expectations. Yeah. So the red. Oh, this is the red one is the cross correlation between the temperature and the polarization, the E-mode polarization. So it's the same data, it's just measured a different way. So B-mode polarization is the thing that's really exciting, and I just want to go through in a little bit more detail what you expect. So if you get perturbations in the space-time metric generated during inflation, or in other words, gravitational waves, what you end up seeing is that if you look at photons that are propagating in this perturbed space-time, you redshift or blueshift these photons a little bit, depending on what's going on with gravitational wave. And these induced frequency shifts in are equivalent then to shifts in the black body temperature of the cosmic microwave background. Okay, so you see these little temperature shifts in delta T. They're way too small to see in the spectrum. But then if you use Thomson scattering to convert those temperature anisotropies to E and B mode polarization anisotropies, then you get this unique curl signature. You get the B mode that you don't get any other way, apart from the caveat I was telling you about. And so you get a very small amplitude, but it's a separable signal. And the cool thing is that the square of the dimensionless amplitude of these gravity waves is the density of the universe during inflation. So it's a direct way of measuring the cosmic density during inflation. So it really is a way of looking at what's going on with the universe when it was much less than a second old. So this is not only interesting for cosmology, but it's also interesting for fundamental physics. In other words, you can probe energy scales that are much higher than scales that you can develop in a laboratory. So this is the plot that I showed you before, just blown up so you can see it a little more carefully. These are various energy scales, inflationary energy scales, and the resulting curve that you would expect to see, and other, just to give you an idea of where those would fall. So there's the state of the art of B-mode polarization now, which means that we have a lot of work to do, so no one's firing me right away, which is good. So at Columbia, we're working on two independent experiments, both designed to measure the same thing, designed to do it in two very, very different ways. And this came about for two reasons. One, because it's really interesting to measure these in different ways so that when you get answers that are different, you can compare them. But also because the systematic errors and the foreground contaminants that you expect are really very, very different in the two. So not only are the instrumental effects different, you're looking at different frequency ranges, so the astronomical contaminants are different. So the first one I'll talk about, I think I put EBEX first, is the EB experiment. This is a high frequency measurement using bolometric detectors. These are essentially just little, very, very sensitive thermistors. And this one flies on a high altitude balloon. And basically, for this kind of work, you're measuring microwave photons, which means that oxygen and water vapor is the enemy. So you want to go to very high, very dry sites. So you either want to go to space if you can, but space is very expensive. Or you go on a balloon platform, or you go to a very high mountaintop. So EBEX is going on a balloon platform. And the other one called QUIET, the QU imaging experiment, is going to 17,000 feet in the Chilean Atacama Desert. So it's a very high, very dry site. And the technology for these two are very different. The frequency range is different. Largely, the frequencies are set both by the detector technology, but also by your platform. So if you're operating from the ground, you want to work at lower frequency because your atmospheric contamination gets worse at higher frequencies. If you're operating on a balloon, you want an enormously sensitive detector, so you don't want one of these coherent polarimeters, which have lots of very nice properties, but they're not as sensitive as bolometers. So that's sort of the trade-off. So here is the team for the EBEX experiment. I will leave that for posterity. You can look at those names later. This is essentially how we expect to do. So here's our publicity slide. So this is a plot that looks a lot like the WMAP plot that I put up a minute ago, except that the temperature anisotropy isn't there. So here's how well we expect to measure the E modes, the B modes, and shown for comparison, this is the sensitivity of EBEX, and there's the sensitivity of Planck, just to give you a sense of where we sit relative to these other experiments. Keep in mind, this is our best effort to say how well we can do, assuming that the instrument works, assuming that we remove foregrounds the way we think we can, assuming we don't have all sorts of instrumental systematics. Generally, even though we're not trying to be dishonest, and no one ever is, you generally don't do quite as well as you hope to do when you get your real data. So whenever you look at these plots, not just ours, but everybody else's, you should realize that although we are very hopeful that we'll see primordial B modes, it may very well be that what we see in the next few years is a really nice measurement of E modes, lensing B modes, and lots of information about foregrounds, which is what we're going to need to develop a satellite experiment to go after the very lowest, very largest scales, which is where we expect to see the primordial B modes. So we might or might not see, depending on the amplitude, primordial B modes. I wouldn't be surprised to find out that to get those, we really need to go to a satellite. But we'll see. Anyway, so we expect to detect the primordial B signal if its strength is about a fifth the current upper limit, or a tensor to scalar ratio of about 0.1. We'll measure the E mode polarization very well. We'll detect CMB lensing, and again, characterize foregrounds. So here's an overview of this experiment. This is a schematic of what the gondola looks like, and I'll show you a picture of the real one in a minute. The light comes in from here, bounces off a couple of mirrors, goes into a cryostat. All of this hardware is designed to attach the instrument to the balloon, and then the balloon flies. First, this summer, we're going to fly from New Mexico for a short flight, about 12 to 24 hours, something like that. Once we prove to the NASA guys that we actually know what we're doing, then we get to fly from Antarctica. So that should happen about a year and a half after the flight. So here's just some details about what it is that we're going to be flying. Here's the gondola being integrated at our Columbia Nevis facility. So this is the real thing. This big guy right here is a mass dummy for where the cryostat goes. The optics are not in there yet. This is the pivot, which attaches to the balloon and allows us to rotate the telescope around. This inner gondola rotates back and forth inside so that you can pick different elevations, and the whole thing rotates around so you can pick where you're looking. So right now what we're doing with it is we're putting on all of the electronics and the motors and all of our different sensors, the sun sensor and the star camera and all these things that tell us where we're going, feedback so we know, not only do we know where we're going, but we can actually do something about controlling where we're going. And the cryostat, which is going to go on there, this gigantic beast, is being integrated at Minnesota. So this is where all of the detectors live. One thing that might or might not be of interest to those of you who think that experimental work is all black boxes is just the difference between a bolometer-based experiment and a coherent polarimeter experiment, which you'll see in a minute. This is a bolometer-based experiment. We've got a whole bunch of these little bolometric detectors that live on these focal planes right here, and I'll show you a picture of one in a minute for a schematic. These detectors are very small. They're enormously sensitive. They're really great detectors, but they don't have polarization sensitivity intrinsically, and they don't have frequency sensitivity intrinsically. So you have to do all of the polarization processing and bandpass filtering in the optics up front. So the optics that you see in this experiment are very complicated compared to what you'll see in the quiet experiment. It's a much, much more sensitive camera, but you have more opportunities to create systematic errors in here with all these optics. So it's a trade-off between this and what I'll show you in a minute. So this is the real cryostat. There are real detectors in there right now. They're being cooled and tested, and so far things are looking really pretty good. So here is what one of these focal planes looks like. This is one of the entire planes that sits at the end of one of these optics chains. So that's what sits right here. If you were to take out an individual one of these guys, it looks something like this. Here's an individual wedge. Each individual bolometer looks something like that. These bolometers are built at Berkeley by Adrian Lee. So you have to filter the radiation up front. You process the polarization up front. The bolometer detects it with very, very high sensitivity. Oh, I forgot I put that there. I was like, why is it not going to the next slide? All right, so to prevent myself from boring all of you who are not that interested in experimental details, I'll move on. Anyone who wants to know more about this, I'm happy to talk about it until you're really bored later. So this is our other experiment called QUIET. So So this is the team. So this is, rather than listing every name, we've listed every institution. Probably totally unfair way to do it, but that's the propaganda slide. So the interesting thing with this experiment is the technology is completely different. So this is based on what's called a coherent polarimeter. Instead of doing all of your polarization processing in the optics, the way I showed you a second ago, you do all of the polarization processing electronically on this little chip. And what's pretty amazing is that this is a polarimeter from the CAPMAP experiment, which is a precursor to this experiment. Each one of these guys is a single pixel, essentially. It takes ages, 50 physicist hours or so to characterize and build and check whether these things, if they work, okay, and they usually don't the first time. They're enormously expensive and they're big, okay, so if you put together something like that, it's about this big. So if you want hundreds of these, it's really, really hard to do. So it was thought for a long time that coherent technology wasn't appropriate for large arrays. To get the sensitivity we need large arrays, so people thought this really wasn't going to work. But JPL has built these incredible little detectors using a bunch of components that were developed for the Planck satellite. So Todd Geyer's team has taken essentially all of these components and packaged them inside one of these little modules. And this is a lot of detail that I don't expect everyone to get. But the bottom line is all of the polarization processing happens on a little module that's about this big, so the size of a postage stamp, which means that now we can pack these into arrays. And so now we're building an experiment that has all of these little modules. They live down here. Up in front of those modules are feed horns, which are essentially just antennas. You split the polarization in a very simple element called ortho mode transducer. All it does is take one polarization. You come in with two polarizations. It takes one, puts it in one little waveguide here, and the other one in the other one. And all the processing happens in the module, and you get out detected Q and U Stokes parameter polarization. So what you see here is a much simpler optical system. There's none of those splitters and filters and all those sorts of things. That all happens on the module. The downside is that these detectors are not nearly as sensitive as the bolometers. So you have to integrate for a whole bunch longer. So this experiment has to go on the ground. EBEX flies on a balloon. So we observe with this one for months. We'll observe for EBEX with days or weeks. So here are just some pictures of where this guy is right now. So we're building the prototype camera at Columbia, 40 gigahertz. This is that platelet array of feed horns. This is the cryostat. Just for scale, the cryostat that you saw a minute ago is much bigger than this one. This is a prototype cryostat. A human is about just a little taller than this cryostat. Here are some of the mirrors that are built, ready to go. And this experiment is going down into the Atacama Desert in Chile. So this is just some vitals about where it's going. This is a really great place to work for all sorts of reasons. Anyway, okay, so it's getting late. I'll stop. So I'll just say that the CMB has really come a long way, but it really still yet has a long way to come. So there are a lot of really exciting things to look forward to. So look for results from the Sanyaya-Zeldovich effect. Look for polarization anisotropy results. I also didn't talk much about small-scale temperature anisotropies that are created by things other than the SD effect. But there are some other interesting things there that ACT and SPT will be doing. So keep watching. I'll stop there.
It would help if you could say how big or small is this polarization that you're looking for. Is it 1%?
Oh, yeah, here.
Hundreds of a percent?
It's a few percent, but you can see in this. There. That should give you a pretty good idea.
So what?
So it depends on scale. Right, what percentage it is of the temperature anisotropy. But the E-modes are polarized sort of at roughly 10%. You get about 10%. And then the B modes, it really depends on what inflationary model, if any, is correct. So we don't know. If the gut scale, if inflation happens at the gut scale, that's more or less this curve here. So it's down then another by a couple orders of magnitude.
So I actually had a question. So you mentioned the polarimeters. Is that that's what Planck is using to measure polarization? Or because you mentioned these two technologies, right?
Planck is using bolometers.
Bolometers.
And their polarimetry is pretty different, actually, from the EVEX one. So
why is your sensitivity so much better than Planck?
Because we have many, many more detectors. That's the biggest thing. But also because the experiment is designed specifically to look at this polarization, which means that some of the processing is different. But the biggest thing is the number of detectors. So we're going to have an order of 1,000 detectors, and Planck has an order of 10. So.
So if you push these in deep measurements to lower and lower scales, which means that back in angle scales, back in time, you probably start getting sensitive to the energy density in passive radiation, like neutrinos, whatever else can occur. Are there good prospects of improving the constraints on the number of neutrinos?
Yeah, I mean, you can get, so WMF has already put some constraints on the neutrino density. Yeah, you can get better. The polarization will help to some degree because you break some of the degeneracies. It's not, I don't know how big the error bars will be with Planck. They're not gonna shrink a huge amount, I don't think.
You have to go all the way back, right?
Well, it depends on what you're trying to do. I mean,
not the masses, the number of neutrinos, right? The number of neutrinos. That's the effective temperature of the neutrinos.
Yeah.
It's the most important thing because it's predicted from out of the Big Bang, like the root of the third power of 4 of 11, right? So this is the one of the few predictions that you have for sure, right?
Yeah, I mean, the issue is that on the very largest scales, the temperature anisotropy is already cosmic variance limited. So it doesn't matter how many more times we measure that. We're not getting any more on the largest scales. And on the smallest scales, what we're really going to start getting is secondary anisotropies, which is not also going to tell us very much about that. So I'm not sure how much is there. I mean, we'll shrink some, but...
So I've heard a talk about this, and the claim is that with ACT you can get, I think, 10% or even better accuracy in the number of neutrinos. So it doesn't make much sense, but it could be like you can say with the accuracy of 0.1 that there are three neutrinos. But by head with ACT you can do it, or probably with SPT the same thing.
Yeah, I mean, essentially what they're doing is they're looking, what's not shown here is where the secondary anisotropies come up, which is somewhere around all of 1,000. So as you get a much better handle on this spectrum as it goes into the secondary anisotropies, you get some additional power. So I forget what the size of the error bar is now. I don't know if it's going to do quite as well as Niash says it might, but I'm not sure exactly. It depends.
So do you have any measurement of the SDA power spectrum you can tell us about?
We do. It's not ready for public consumption yet. I'll tell you there are no big surprises from what we can tell so far, but it'll be out soon.
Wait, no surprises for theorists or people looking at existing data?
Are those different things? So I'll show you this. This is not going to answer your question, but I'll show you. So the data from CBI and BIMA here, but I'm not going to say whether we're going to revolutionize that or not, but I'm giving you a hint that probably is from what we see so far. The error bars will be smaller, they'll have a better measurement, but that's all I'm going to say. It'll be out soon, actually.
questions. God bless, thank you very much. The workshop is at 4:15.